Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 3, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the newly proposed CO2 rules. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two expert attorneys, both partners at Baker & Hostetler. The first is Mr. Mark W. Delaquille, and the second is Mr. David B. Rivkin, Jr. More complete bios for both speakers were provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mark Delaquille, who's going to get things rolling for us.
Thank you. Over the last several years, one of the hottest topics in environmental law and in administrative law has been how the Clean Air Act works, and in particular, how the Clean Air Act works with regard to greenhouse gases. I won't bore everyone on the call with the discussion of what greenhouse gases are, except to say that the primary greenhouse gas in the context of the most Clean Air Act programs is carbon dioxide. And unless anyone wants to quibble on these issues, if I say carbon dioxide, you can hear greenhouse gases, and if I say greenhouse gases, you can hear carbon dioxide. Following the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts versus EPA in 2007, EPA has taken several steps to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. The first step was its endangerment determination, which found that greenhouse gases could be reasonably expected to cause or contribute to air pollution that would harm the public health. EPA followed those actions with regulation of greenhouse gases from motor vehicles, which took the form of fuel economy standards, and through the regulation of greenhouse gases in pre-construction permitting of large industrial facilities. The Supreme Court is currently considering the lawfulness of that latter program. Yesterday, EPA announced another major regulatory proposal for regulating greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. This proposal concerns existing power plants and is a particularly notable proposal because it is the first time EPA has proposed regulating existing sources of greenhouse gases that have not taken some type of triggering action, such as the construction of a new facility or the modification of an existing facility. In other words, this is the first greenhouse gas regulatory program under the Clean Air Act that regulates facilities because of what they are in the course of business rather than because of something that they've done. The Clean Air Act is famous for its alphabet soup of acronyms, NAAQS, which are the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, NSPS, which are the New Source Performance Standards, and I won't bore you with too many of those, except to ask you to remember two phrases. The first is standards of performance. EPA's regulations, its proposed regulations, are under Section 111 of the Act governing standards of performance for certain categories of sources. The second term, and the last term, is Best System of Emission Reduction, or BSER. That's the Clean Air Act's technical term for what a standard of performance is based on. Most standards of performance under the Clean Air Act regulate new sources, and EPA has proposed performance standards for new sources of power plants twice over the past year, with expected finalization of those actions in January. those standards of performance are based on the best system of emission reduction. Historically, the best system of emission reduction has been an end-of-pipe control, something like a bag house, which is a fabric filter at the end of a stack or before a stack that catches particles of air pollution and prevents them from being emitted in the air. And the standard of performance is the level of emission performance that is correlated with the proper use of that pollution control device. In its Section 111D proposal, announced yesterday, EPA has sought to expand the term best standard of emission reduction to include not just improvements in the emission performance of a fossil fuel powered power plant, but also the use of certain types of power plants which are lower greenhouse gas emissions over others, the employment of unregulated power plants under the Clean Air Act, such as nuclear power plants, to offset emissions from coal-fired power plants, and third, the use of demand-side performance measures, such as net metering or other programs that reduce the end use of electricity as a system of emission reduction for coal-fired power plants. I'm sure you'll have lots of questions about the lawfulness of that this program, as do we, but suffice it to say that in our view it marks a fundamental shift in the way that EPA has regulated greenhouse gases and other pollutants under the Clean Air Act, moving from a system based on the emission performance of individual sources to a system based on a reorganization of the energy infrastructure to focus on sources with lower levels of greenhouse gas emissions. Noticeably, one of the options for compliance under the rule, under the proposed rule, is a multi-state cap and trade system like the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the Northeast United States. And a cap and trade system is exactly what Congress was unable to adopt through legislation for much of the last 15 years. It's in many ways a complicated proposal, and I would be happy to talk about the details of EPA's 650-page notice, but I think before we do that, it makes sense to turn it over to David for his views on the larger implications of the rule.
Thank you, Mark. Pretty much covered all the basics. I would just add few points. One of the problems here, in addition to the fact that these are not end of a tailpipe controls or source specific controls, with regard to all the other pollutants, even the EPA regulates large categories of sources that EPA does under the Clean Air Act in the context of approving things like state implementation plans, where states come in the first instance on their own and propose emission budgets and maintenance plans to ensure that they are complying with national ambient air quality standards, and once they attain them, that they can stay in maintenance. The EPA does that. At least it has an overarching, scientifically driven, let's use the word bogey. You know what the relevant standard you are trying to attain, be it for ozone or some other pollutant. And then it's the question of allocation of burdens to different sources. One of the biggest problems, despite Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts versus EPA that has declared carbon to be greenhouse gases to be a pollutant subject to potentially being regulated under the Clean Air Act, the statute itself has not provided any particular structured process for figuring out what the overall emission targets are supposed to be for carbon. Now, EPA has talked about doing ambient standards for carbon, but we're not there yet. So we're about to go through a process that would lead to billions of dollars being expanded by the economy, even if you take the most generous assumptions in favor of administration's position, with all sorts of reductions, ladies and gentlemen, loosely tied to such, you know, concepts as let's show our international leadership, let's do it cost effective, but without any clear sense of what is it the part of, unlike reductions regard to all other emissions. Point number one. Point number two, not only Congress has not decided to adopt, two political branches come together have been unable to adopt cap and trade, but Congress has paid no attention by virtue of not being able to address it legislatively. There's a very clear tension between what EPA is doing here, which is, as Mark mentioned, is regulating for the first time on a nationwide basis the way electricity is being generated under the Clean Air Act, and the tension between this effort and a number of other federal and state statutes. The most prominent one is the Federal Power Act, which vests FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, with certain jurisdiction, and at the same time leaves a great deal of power to be exercised by the states as part of their police power. And you can certainly envision circumstances. There's a tension between something that a state told its utilities they have to do to comply with the final version of this 111 deregulation and their obligations to provide reliable service, both in the context of the Federal Power Act and in the context of state statutes, because states have, up to now in our constitutional system, been the primary drivers of a generation decision. So we may find ourselves in a number of situations where a given source may be facing conflicting legal obligations, which of course would raise due process problems. And the final point, which again stems from the fact that Congress has not addressed it, we're doing this under an old provision in the Clean Air Act, is that Congress has not given any attention about how far it wants to divest states of responsibility in this area. And as we know from a variety of fundamental principles of federalism and the Supreme Court cases, the decisions to which extent you want to preempt state authority is a decision that Congress has to address very carefully. And in fact, in the case decided yesterday called Bond versus United States, at least six justices of the United States Supreme Court have made very clear that then Congress is trying to divest states of traditional areas of state responsibility, a subset of a general police power that the states exercise. Congress has to speak to this issue with crystalline clarity, far greater than the clarity that is typically needed to attain what we call in administrative law a Chevron 1 level of clarity about what the statute means. So none of those important things have happened. And let me close by saying that as important as this issue is in its own right, we're talking about billions of dollars, we're talking about reliability, which is the ability of folks in the hottest and coldest days of a year to obtain reliable service. We're also talking about a very important, another chapter in a long chapter of this administration's efforts to do things unilaterally using statutory tools, which even if there's a legal matter, can be used to bear the weight that's being attached to them. We're certainly not optimized for doing that. And that's extremely unfortunate in the long run. That's not how our democracy is supposed to function. Thank you.
Well, should we go to the audience and take some questions? Or?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, for those of you on the line, in a moment we'll open the floor to your questions. You'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on, and after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, to ask a question, press star and the pound key. And it looks like we have a couple callers that jumped on the line.
Yes, I have a question. I'd be curious to know what is the precise form the regulation takes in terms of does each state have a budget In particular, to the extent that a state is trying to comply by having consumers consume less electricity, how is it determined that they're doing that, or is it rather determined by just the total emissions in the state based upon what has been accomplished by consumers consuming less? And then how do they figure out, let's say, if in my state my consumers are consuming less, but the electricity is being generated elsewhere and it's going over the budget there. So, I mean, how does this thing work?
Well, it's an excellent question, and I don't want to punt by saying it's extremely complicated, but it is extremely complicated. EPA has the metric that EPA uses and has set as a requirement for individual states to meet in their state plan is a carbon dioxide output-based emission rate, pounds of carbon dioxide per megawatt hour of electricity produced. And that metric will apply to all the electricity produced in aggregate in a state. So, as an example, if your target is 1,000, if your state's target emission rate is 1,000 pounds of carbon dioxide per megawatt hour of electricity produced in 2030, which is the end horizon of the regulation, and you, for a system-wide average in your state today, are at 1,500 pounds of carbon dioxide per megawatt hour of energy produced, at that, a number that would be very roughly equivalent to half coal and half gas. You would have to do something, whether it is more gas generation, more renewable generation, more nuclear, less coal, improvements in efficiency at coal plants, reduction of demand, to get yourself down to the pounds of to the emission rate target. And one of the really striking features of the regulation is that different states have very different emission rate targets by 2030, based largely on EPA's assessment of the potential for reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the state
in a cost-effective fashion
than on the current generation mix as it stands today. So if EPA believes that there is a high potential for the employment of renewable energy, a state could have to reduce emissions more than if EPA considers there to be a low potential for the employment of renewable energy. And to some extent, that applies to demand-side measures, i.e., things that make people consume less electricity. And so a state like Washington, I believe, will have a 70% reduction between 2005 and 2030. That's at the high end. And certain other states would have targets that are more like 20%. You asked a question about how EPA translates something that is necessarily hard to measure, like demand-side performance measures and how you reduce electricity consumption, into an apple that can be compared. There's a complicated methodology for doing that in the rule, and given its release yesterday, I won't profess to totally understanding it, except to say that when folks have been discussing the possibility that EPA could set an emission rate-based standard rather than a mass-based standard, that's one of the concerns that's often raised. How do you make that reduction verifiable, make sure it actually happens, make sure it's consistent among the states, and, as you mentioned, make sure there is equity among the states that are importers and exporters of electricity?
Let me just add one 60,000 feet above the battlefield point observation. What's in this proposal is ambitious enough, unprecedented enough. But I would also like to direct your attention that there is no cabining principle here. But if EPA can nudge the states, force the states to proceed down this path, and everybody, of course, is focusing on the fact that the states have flexibility. Well, the states have flexibility in the first instance to absorb this and submit compliant SIPs, state of inflation plans. If EPA does not find them to be compliant, EPA will do it for them. So EPA is basically taking the position that they, in the future, let's say, is going to be, you know, post 2030, the sun off first wave of 111 deregulations. EPA can compel all sorts of things that are commonly known in this world as industrial policy and even residential behavior modifications. So EPA can tell folks, you know, how much electricity to consume. Mm-hmm. EPA can tell industrial sources how much electricity. You can literally have on a gigantic scale, I don't mean to be provocative here, the kind of a global VA or nationwide VA type situation where you would have a budget and you would have, you know, long waiting lines and all sorts of other problems. Now, that's not, to be fair, what's in this proposal, but I don't see, given EPA's view of its legal authority, I don't see why EPA would be unable to do something like this in the future, again, without any congressional consideration.
All right. We've got three callers pending, and we have plenty of time left for questions. So if you'd like to get in line, press star and then the pound key.
Hi, this is Mario Loyola, Texas Public Policy Foundation. I wanted to ask a question about possible vulnerabilities in litigation of this rule as compared to other rules and some of the familiar theories that have not worked in the past that might stand a better chance of prospering this time around. In particular, I'd like you gentlemen, if you could, to address whether a takings claim, a regulatory takings claim, is liable to be more is liable to have better prospects this time around, because at least with respect to the coal industry, it does appear that these assets are being deprived of substantially all their value or stand to by the rule in its operation. And secondly, which Mr. Rifkin just alluded to a little bit, the problem of cooperative federalism as commandeering. This is of particular interest to me, having just read the Yale Law Journal's April 2014 symposium, which I would commend to all of you, in which several left-wing, well, let's not say left-wing, but liberal law professors are ready to freely concede that all of these cooperative federalism programs boil down to commandeering, and it's a great thing because the national government should be in control of states, and states have the most important role to play in federalism because they have the power of the servants, quote unquote. And I think that they've done the country, those law professors have done the country a great service by finally admitting what conservatives have been saying all along, which is that these cooperative federalism programs boil down to commandeering. And hopefully the Supreme Court will see in this test case that nobody takes its pronouncements on the sovereignty of the state seriously anymore.
Well, thank you, Mario. Let me begin, and then Mark may add some things. First of all, let me say boldly, but I take no second seat in my passion for federalism, having Mark as well, for that matter. I've been involved in the challenge to Obamacare and various other federalism enhancing projects. I'm afraid I don't agree with the notion that there is a viable commandeering claim, at least as that term has been defined in cases like New York and Princeton. NFIB, the way states are being asked to proceed here, they're given an opportunity to come up with a compliant state implementation plans. If such plans are not submitted, EPA will promulgate it for them. That's tried and true Clean Air Act model, and in fact, compared to some, at least in this respect, compared with some other things that EPA has done in the greenhouse gas area, where they basically retroactively invalidated virtually all the SIPs in the nation and gave a number of states, which Mark and I actually litigated in the D.C. Circuit on behalf of a great state of Texas, came up with the FIPS. This is not nearly as bad as what we've seen before. So I don't see a commandeering claim here, point number one. I don't see a takings claim, certainly in a facial challenge, because the regulatory taking, in all its, aside from the difficulties of proving it, is very much an asset-specific exercise, and while you can do statistical calculations about the value of stranded assets that folks in various industries would have, you can go to court and say, well, I just calculated, you know, for purposes of, you know, projections, that five coal mines that I own would be worth less this much once the rule is implemented, assuming various other things take place, and I cannot sell my coal for export because various regular agencies have not done enough permitting relative to new shipping facilities, et cetera, et cetera. So I just don't see how in any facial challenge the takings will come up. Now, what is possible to do here, and I'm sure would be tried, is a straightforward sort of traditional agency acted beyond the Chevron discretion. That's not, you know, the language of 111D, while capacious, and system of emission reductions language, while capacious, does not bear the kind of weight that is being attached to it. As I said briefly, we haven't scrubbed this in great detail, but having read the bond decision yesterday, I am tantalized by the notion that the chief and actually four liberal justices, and Kennedy, take the view that if you squeeze the traditional area of state police power, you have to speak with unbelievable level of clarity and certitude. And to what extent, of course, that was done in the context of local criminal law, but bond can be read, you know, could be read broader than that, and to what extent that impacts the Chevron analysis in the sense that you can say, well, look, the language is very capacious, but one thing you cannot do as part of your Chevron discretion, absent crystalline clarity from Congress, is divest state of its traditional, you know, age-old police power prerogatives. Now, all of that is interesting and has promise, particularly if the states were to, and I think states will, jump into the fray in large numbers as they've done with challenge to Obamacare. By the way, let me say this also, just in aggregate, should have said it in my brief opening remarks. In terms of it being a power grab, this is the boldest power grab I've seen out of this administration, except for Obamacare, and Obamacare, warts and all, at least was done by statute. This was done by regulation. So states would undoubtedly come forward. Unfortunately, we're stuck with a D.C. Circuit, and so I don't want to depress everybody in this call. The D.C. Circuit has not been very willing to cabinet PA's ability to do those things, and Supreme Court has not been terribly excited about stepping into the fray either, but hopefully this will be a different exercise given, again, the magnitude of a change and the extent to which it squeezes the states. Mark, go ahead.
Sure. Just a few follow-up points. On the issue of commandeering, this is an area where, as you mentioned, Mario, unfortunately, the law seems not to match the reality. A Clean Air Act regulation that would effectively require a state to promulgate a plan that sets forth the extent to which electricity can be produced by one type of source, whether it's coal, whether it's gas, versus another source that addresses the type of demand-side measures that would reduce electricity, that promotes one type of renewable energy versus another, is a matter that a state really must do on its own to exercise its sovereign prerogatives. And EPA's choice, Congress's choice, that the state must do that, and if it does not do so in a way approvable to EPA, that EPA will have authority under Congress's Commerce Clause power to do so, is not much of a choice as a factual matter. unfortunately, also, as David mentioned, we have litigated commandeering coercion challenges under the 10th Amendment and states' inherent sovereign authority in Clean Air Act cases, and they have proven to be difficult. So this is, you know, somewhere that future development of the law may allow a viable challenge, and whether this regulation is a suitable vehicle for future development of the law is something that we'll all have to think carefully about. On the issue of regulatory takings, I think you have much the same issue. The standard for a regulatory taking is obviously very high and very property specific. I could argue that the remediation costs of closing a stranded cost coal-fired power plant that a company just sunk $800 million in pollution controls over the last few years to comply with EPA's last set of regulations is as egregious a regulatory taking as can be imagined, and I think there could be a place for that as the specific effects of the rule shake out. However, in the way our jurisprudence is developed does give Congress and agencies wide latitude to protect certain public goods like public health and environmental values, even at the extent of significant economic cost to individuals and individual businesses. So that, too, I think is something that bears consideration, but that will have to be looked at with more focus on the factual effect of the rule and possibly even over time. The final thing you mentioned that interested me was the arguments that have not succeeded in the past, and certainly that's something that I've thought a lot about over the last few years, as has David, I know, and you don't want to be refighting the last war. On the other hand, you know, in many cases, the infirmity in an agency's action is what it is. And one of the concerns about this proposal is that it takes the term I mentioned, best system of emission reduction, and interprets it to have no limiting principle. If the best system of emission reduction can be or can include doing something else, like that's not, you know, a power plant issue, for example, you know, reducing demand, why couldn't that be something like not turning the lights on Wednesdays,
right,
not running plants on Wednesdays? Why, you know, that would be ostensibly a 1/7 reduction there. And so the term, you know, there has to be a limitation to the interpretation that is not just, you know, anything that affects the ultimate power output in aggregate or the ultimate pollutant output in aggregate of the facilities. So while, you know, we want to find new and, you know, innovative and correct legal strategies for challenging rules, we also can't lose sight of what the established principles would say in this case, even if they were not necessarily successful in the last.
Right, and let me just say, even in a post-check poultry world, the notion that EPA, and we can all come up with a parade of horribles, that's what I meant earlier by lack of cabining principle, the notion that EPA can engage in an endless variety of regulation of every business and every lifestyle. Let me try to trump my partner here and give you another example. Why couldn't EPA develop building codes? There are different environmental statutes have, particularly administered by DOE, but some by EPA, have ability for agencies to come up with standards for certain types of equipment. But there's no sort of a comprehensive building code power vested in the federal government by any statute. Well, why couldn't EPA say everybody should have Adobe-style houses because they're more energy efficient, or you should not build anything over two stories high? And under the logic they're using to deal with existing sources, why can't you tell people but they have to tear down existing structures? I mean, I don't know of any way to find a limiting principle given what we've seen of EPA's articulation of its legal authority.
All right. Well, we've got actually five questions pending on the lines and just about 25 minutes left, so we'll move right to our next caller.
Hi, this is Leo Dombrowski, Society member in Chicago. Carbon dioxide is obviously the driver behind the proposal because of all the terrible things it's doing to us now and is going to be doing to us in the future. I have read, though, in some press accounts that the proposal will also result in a significant reduction of criteria pollutants, carbon, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, et cetera. Number one, is that the case? And number two, if so, is that simply going to be the result of us all consuming a lot less electricity and natural gas while we freeze in the winter and overheat in the summer?
This is Mark, and the short answer is basically yes and yes. It's a simple fact of the matter that a coal-fired power plant produces more sulfur dioxide and, you know, also relative than any other type of source or major comparably sized industrial source, and also produces fairly large amounts of other criteria pollutants such as nitrogen oxides and particulate matter. And so as electric generation is either not consumed through demand side or shifts to other sources of electric production, there will be some declines in criteria pollutants. My view on this subject has always been simple. The Clean Air Act sets national ambient air quality standards for each of those criteria pollutants. If EPA believes that the level of those standards is not sufficiently protective of public health, using the best possible science and taking and considering that science appropriately and not applying unrealistic and unreasonable risk control measures to it, then EPA's obligation under the Act and the straightforward and fundamentally clear way to do that is to reset that standard, and under the Act, that would then give states a choice of which emission sources it would like to reduce within its footprints. And if the actual national levels are sufficiently protective and we are in attainment of those levels, that there is, by definition, no benefit to reducing those pollutants, absent a non-attainment situation. So, you know, while the administration has mentioned a reduction of criteria pollutants as a benefit of the rule slash motivating factor of the rule, and I don't take issue with the administration's or EPA's prediction that this would result, I also don't think that EPA ought to be making regulatory policy for one pollutant by talking about all the other benefits it would have on a different pollutant controlled by a different program.
Let me just add in 10 seconds, this kind of a shell game is something that EPA, particularly under this administration, has been playing quite a bit. And it, as Mark said, it is not justified by the way the Clean Air Act works, and it also makes it much more difficult to assess the economic cost effectiveness of what's done here, because you're just throwing a lot of things on the table here.
All right. We've still got five questions on the line, and we'll move right to the next one.
This is Hillary Sills. I'm not a lawyer. I'd like to ask a couple of questions, though, about a suitable challenge to the rule. This rule appears to have very disparate impacts between the states, with some states, I think people point to Texas as an example, being required to do a great deal and other states less. So I'm wondering about that as a challenge. Then within a state, I guess, you know, there's a lot of equity issues from one utility to another. I take it that that has been thrown at the states, and EPA is not getting into those issues at all. That, I guess, becomes a total state issue. And then the final question is that Section 111 refers repeatedly to the source and that the standards apply to the source. But in this rule, the BSER goes quite far afield from the source, and I'm wondering if that is going to be a fruitful area of challenge. Thank you.
Thank you, Hillary. Well, let me tackle the first two, and Mark can do the third one. As far as asymmetrical burdens being imposed on the state, Mark and I actually talked about this before we saw the proposal, because there is a body of case law, Hillary, that talks, not a very large number of cases, but it does exist. It talks about sort of principle of sovereign equality. You cannot really, if you're a federal government, dramatically and explicitly disadvantage one state over another by imposing, for example, this case last time arose in the context of a challenge to the gambling, the statute allowed gambling in some states like Nevada, but did not give us opportunity to New Jersey. But that's not the case here. There's a common bogey, at least as far as the carbon intensity of electricity being generated is concerned, and the fact that states have to bear different burdens to get there is not at all new to the Clean Air Act, because if you have, for example, a uniform national standard, like National Ambient Air Quality Standard, if you're a state with a large emission inventory, you would have to reduce a lot more to get there to have a compliant SIP. So that's, this dog probably would not hunt. As far as decisions about which industry to squeeze or which subset of your utility players to squeeze, again, this is something that states can do under the Clean Air Act. That's how they do things relative to their both attainment and maintenance SIPs. Always been like that. To the extent they don't do it, the federal government does a FIP, they're really standing in the shoes of a state that failed to submit a compliant SIP. So I don't see that as a huge problem. Mark, why don't you tackle that?
I'll discuss the third, and then I'll briefly touch on the first two. On Section 111D, and for those on the call who are not as familiar with the Clean Air Act, that's the specific regulatory subsection this proposal is being advanced under, does talk about standards of performance at sources, and it regularly talks about sources. And I certainly agree that this is a marked departure from any interpretation of best system of emission reduction EPA's ever advanced. And what David and I were attempting to grasp when we talked about a lack of a limiting principle or lack of a cabining principle is just what you say, Hillary. Once you have departed from the type of thing that can happen at the specific type of regulated source, language like best and emission reduction is sufficiently vague and contentless that nearly anything can go. One other interesting aspect of Section 111D is that there is a quite good legal argument that EPA ought not be regulating greenhouse gases from electric utilities under Section 111D at all in any way, given that EPA has also promulgated air toxic standards for the industry under Section 112 of the Act. William Hahn wrote a fine paper for the Federalist Society on this topic last year, and I did a podcast with him about that paper several weeks later. I think it's a little far afield of this proposal right now, but it's certainly something I would commend to the attention of everyone on this call. On the issue of equity between states, given the separate emission rate budgets, and equity between individual companies within a state, I expected EPA to set different standards for different states based on what the current composition of their industry was, and potentially based to some extent on the potential for renewable resources in that state. But I have to say that I was shocked at just how different the states are being treated under EPA's proposal. I mentioned Washington as a state with the emission reductions approaching 70% for between 2005 and 2030, but the use of the 2005 baseline also artificially inflates artificially hides how big the emission reduction requirements are in another state. And you mentioned Texas. That's an excellent example. Texas has had a vibrant economy between 2005 and 2014 today, and has higher greenhouse gas emissions than it did then. So the reductions in that state are liable to be more difficult and more painful than many other states. And whether or not that rises to a constitutional equal sovereignty issue is one that will need to be explored in light of the language of the rule. But it's certainly something that gives rise to a question of arbitrariness in regulatory design. A similar situation could occur among the regulated utilities in an individual state, given their different generating fleets, you know, when different power plants were built, that type of thing. But I think that really is, EPA has said, you know, states, that's something for you to sort out with them. As I mentioned, one of the difficult things about this rule for a state is because those are the types of decisions a state really does need to make. But EPA has also said that it'll step in and make the decisions for the state if a state chooses not to do so.
Yeah, just to add one point, and again, I didn't mean to suggest that it's not worth analyzing. What I should have said is that it's at least as a first impression, the burdens are not completely asymmetrical in that they're supposed to be imposed in the attainment of the sort of a common uniform energy intensity target. But let me also say, and at the risk of sounding political, that there is perhaps, in addition to arbitrariness, there's a certain interesting political calculation here. I've seen a number of studies that suggest that red states have experienced pretty robust economic growth, in part because of overall regulatory system, because of pensions, because of right to work, but also because of price of electricity generally being much more modest. So to the extent that this hits hard, particularly those states that have actually experienced an increase in aggregate demand as a result of growing economy since 2005, I would venture a guess that it hits, all things being equal, red states harder than blue states. Not there are other factors in terms of whatever cost, if you say what about Washington, because it's cost effectiveness of reductions and various resources you have available. But at least as far as one component of a matrix is concerned, there is possibly a bit of the unfortunate political calculation here.
Well, that certainly, you know, a hard look at which states have the most difficult compliance burdens and which states have the least difficult compliance burdens is well warranted.
All right. Well, we have three questions still left on the line, and hopefully we'll be able to get to all of them. If you could, for our callers, please keep your questions as brief as possible, and we'll go to the next caller.
Uh, Hi, guys. This is Lee Logan with Inside EPA Newsletter. Wanted to explore a little bit more on the on this issue of BSER and kind of EPA's expansive look at it. Am I right that you guys think that this might be one of the better ways to potentially challenge the rule? And if so, beyond this issue of EPA not limiting it, itself on the its determination, is there something in the statute that kind of limits EPA's discretion to more inside the fence rather than outside the fence issues?
Well, thanks, Lee. This is Mark DeLaQuil. On the first question about legal challenges, and I think given the content of the rule and the history of litigation under the Clean Air Act, this we could expect legal challenges, and that I'm not sure I would say that the definition of BSER is it would necessarily be the driver of the challenge. I'm always reminded here of Justice Scalia's quote from the Whitman versus American Trucking Association's case that Congress does not hide elephants in mouse holes, and standard of performance and best system of emission reduction has a long history of being a source-specific type of program. I mentioned the example of setting a emission standard based on the performance of a baghouse, and to be fair, in the Bush administration's Clean Air Mercury Rule, EPA did propose a regulation that would allow a cap-and-trade program under Section 111D, but only with regard to sources in one specific source category, which was the coal-fired power plant category. Here, what EPA's done is set a target for states that expressly, I would say not just authorizes, but necessitates a state to regulate not just one category of sources, which are coal-fired power plants and natural gas-fired power plants, but all types of electric generation through binding emission standards in order to come up with a system of emission reduction, again, the statute's words, for one category of sources, the power plants. So that's one way that may play out. But again, not to repeat myself, but Congress doesn't hide elephants in mouse holes.
Actually, Congress, Scalia.
I'll make an exception for Scalia. That a program of this magnitude that is fundamentally unlike anything promulgated under Section 111D or any part of the Clean Air Act, and is in fact far more transformative than other programs that have been put into the Clean Air Act through legislative changes, like the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990s. Acid rain cap and trade program, raise questions. A change of that magnitude simply raises questions about whether it was intended to be allowed by the statute at all.
All right. Well, let's see if we can get to our two questions still pending with about 5 minutes left. So, right to the next caller.
Hi, this is Roger Condorlati. First, I want to thank you guys for a tremendous job and for digging into this thing. I thought from the news accounts that I was beginning to understand it until I hear the complexities that you describe. I'm more confused than ever. let me just throw out a quick hypo and then see how this, if you can relate this to the earlier statement that there's some kind of equity, at least among states, if not among human beings. Okay, so electricity is generated at a coal-fired plant in Arizona, and it's used in Colorado. And part of it's used to heat a swimming pool of some rich Democratic donor in Aspen, and another part is used to irrigate alfalfa in southern Colorado and pinto beans in western Colorado. And those pinto beans are headed for Mexico, and the alfalfa is going to be consumed by native livestock. So the alfalfa absorbs it, CO2, takes it out of the air, and the cattle that eat that alfalfa are going to put it back in. And some is productive use, and some is like recreational use up in the swimming pool in Aspen. And the pinto beans are all headed for Mexico by rail. How in the world can anybody say that there's any, that somebody's thought through the equity considerations at all as to whether this makes sense from even a scientific point of view when you don't know what the electricity is going to be used for?
Well, let me briefly respond. There's a certain elegance and also in your question, but it also evokes a certain anxiety in me. Yes, we're not talking about life cycle costs here in that the rule applies to the energy intensity, the greenhouse gas intensity on the energy generation side. And of course, with exception of demand management, it does not make distinctions between electricity being used from your hypothetical to produce something that actually is a net consumer of greenhouse gases versus the net potential contributor to further emission down the line. They haven't done that, but I mean, on the other hand, the anxiety, the question of Oaks and me is, you, absent the cabining principle, limiting principle that Mark and I are talking about, you can come up with a broader rule that comes, so broadens the industrial policy that EPA is pushing here beyond our hypothetical of, you know, new buildings and no turning, you know, electricity rationing into EPA specifying that you are able to trade off between the carbon intensity on the generation side and carbon intensity of the uses to which this energy is being put. So you either augmented or diminish the energy intensity on the generation side, in which case EPA can tell you what crops to grow, what products to make, you know, what food to eat. And it's not a pretty picture.
I recognize the equity concerns, but I am uncomfortable, extremely uncomfortable with EPA or other federal government agencies making pollution control policy based on their assessment of the value of a consumer's end use of electricity. It's an area that, to me, makes me quite uncomfortable.
We both agree on that, but let me just say, we also, I think, Mark, both agree that that is something to which, in a different administration, EPA could go under its view of its legal authority. Because if a system of emission limitations is not a source-specific set of technology-based controls, well, then why couldn't you sweep the end use into the regulatory vortex? So, troubling, but scary question.
This is Christian. We have one more caller on the line. Do you two, but we're right at our time. Do you have time to do a couple?
Sure, we'll do one more.
One more.
Okay, great.
Hi, this is David Schoenbrot. I asked the first question, so I guess I'll be last too. The EPA says that this rule is going to produce a whole lot of cap and trade. We're going to get a lot of efficiencies from cap and trade. But as I hear you describe the thing, it doesn't sound like we have a very unconstrained marketplace here. EPA is making a lot of decisions about who could do what, and besides, the trading is only within the electricity sector. Could you comment, please?
Go ahead, Mark.
I think that EPA had a strong desire to preserve the existing state cap and trade programs. I mentioned the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, but there are other programs as well, Western Climate Change Partnership, I believe. But in any case, EPA very strongly wanted to preserve those systems, and EPA may or may not, it's simply not clear to me yet, expect that other states would seek to join those systems or would seek to form different regional cap and trade programs. It's certainly an option for compliance under the Act, and it's one that EPA has offered states an additional two-year extension on their plan submissions if they are working out a state cap-and-trade program or a multi-state cap-and-trade program. So it is one way to comply under the Act. It does raise questions about equivalency and turning emission rates into mass emissions. The rule also addresses that, but I'm not sure that all the questions have been answered yet. But you raise one more fundamental point with that, which is EPA made some very specific judgments about how a state could reach the emission rate targets when it set best system of emission reduction through an analysis of, you know, EPA's expectations on efficiency improvements at existing coal-fired power plants, through additional dispatch of gas-fired power plants, employment of renewable resources, employment of other types of technologies, and if a state does not want to replicate that in its ultimate program, a cap-and-trade system may well be the easiest way for a state to do something else or something fundamentally different than what EPA did in setting the ultimate emission rate target.
Yeah, and let me just close by adding that it's our strong suspicion that sort of further making the marketplace more shallow, in addition to everything that Mark said, is the EPA's unquestionable thirst to destroy coal. And I think they played with the numbers in a way that assures that the end result is going to be that. So it really is different in this respect from sort of a fundamental, truly agnostic cap and trade. And while I'm not a fan of command and control stuff, I also want to say that the notion that a lot of folks espouse that everything is just wonderful because you have trading is silly, because when you have a fundamentally bad regulatory regime, a modicum of trading does not salvage it from being bad.
All right. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both our experts today. Thank you also to our audience. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsuc.org. And don't forget to check out our website for videos from the second annual Executive Branch Review Conference from last month. And with that, we're adjourned. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.